pain of waiting. She turned at last to look at me, eyes clear and appraising under thick ruddy brows. "Would you have done it, if you could?"
"If I could?"
"You said once that you hated me when you were pregnant. If you could have not been..."
"God, not you," I blurted, horror-stricken. "Not you, ever. It..."
I knotted my hands together to still their trembling.
"No,"
I said, as positively as I could. "Never."
"You did say so," she said, looking at me intently. "When you told me about Dar."
I rubbed a hand across my face, trying to focus my thoughts.
"Yes, I had told her that. Idiot."
It was a horrible time. Terrible. We were starving. It was war. The world was coming apart at the seams. Wasn't hers. At the time, it seemed as though there was no hope. I had to leave Jamie, and the thought drove almost everything else out of my mind. "But there was one other thing," I said.
"What was that?"
"It wasn't rape," I said softly, meeting her eyes. "I loved your father." She nodded, her face a little pale.
"Yes, but it might be Rogers. You did say that, didn't you?"
"Yes, it might." "Is the possibility enough for you?" She laid a hand over her stomach, long fingers gently curved.
"Yeah. Well, it isn't an it to me. I don't know who it is, but..."
She stopped suddenly and glanced at me, looking suddenly shy.
"I don't know if this sounds... well..."
She shrugged abruptly, dismissing doubt. "I had this sharp pain that woke me up in the middle of the night, a few days... after. Quick! Like somebody had stabbed me with a hatpin, but deep." Her fingers curled inward, her fist pressing just above her pubic bone on the right side.
"Implantation," I said softly, "when the zygote takes root in the womb. When that first eternal link is formed between mother and child, when the small blind entity, unique in its union of egg and sperm, comes to anchor from the perilous voyage of beginning, home from its brief free-floating existence in the body, and settles to its busy work of division, drawing sustenance from the flesh in which it embeds itself, in a connection that belongs to neither side, but to both. That link which cannot be severed, either by birth or by death."
She nodded. "It was the strangest feeling. I was still half asleep, but I...
well, I just knew all of a sudden that I wasn't alone."
Her lips curved in a faint smile, reminiscent of wonder.
"And I said to... it?"
Her eyes rested on mine, still lit by the smile.
"I said, 'Oh, it's you.' And then I went back to sleep."
Her other hand crossed the first, a barricade across her belly.
"I thought it was a dream. That was a long time before I knew. But I remember. It wasn't a dream. I remember."
"I remembered, too." I looked down and saw beneath my hands not the wooden tabletop, nor gleaming blade, but the opal skin and perfect sleeping face of my first child, Faith, with slanted eyes that never opened on the light of earth. Looked up into the same eyes, open now and filled with knowledge. I saw that baby, too, my second daughter, filled with bloody life, pink and crumpled, flushed with fury at the indignities of birth, so different from the calm stillness of the first, and just as magnificent in her perfection. Two miracles I had been given, carried beneath my heart, born of my body, held in my arms, separated from me and part of me forever. I knew much too well that neither death nor time nor distance ever altered such a bond, because I had been altered by it, once and forever changed by that mysterious connection.
"Yes, I understand," I said,
and then said,
"Oh, but Bree,"
as the knowledge of what her decision would mean to her flooded in on me anew.
She was watching me, brows drawn down, lines of trouble in her face. And it occurred to me, belatedly, that she might take my exhortations as the expression of my own regrets. Appalled at the thought that she might think I hadn't wanted her, or had ever wished she hadn't been, I dropped the blade and reached out across the table to her. "Bree," I said, seized with panic at the thought. "Brianna, I love you. Do you believe I love you?" She nodded without speaking, and stretched out a hand toward me. I grasped it like a lifeline, like the cord that had once joined us. She closed her eyes, and for the first time I saw the glitter of tears that clung to the delicate, thick curve of her lashes. "I've always known that, Mama," she whispered. Her fingers tightened around mine. I saw her other hand press flat against her stomach. "From the beginning." Chapter 50, in which all is revealed. By late November, the days as well as the nights were cold, and the rain clouds began to hang lower on the slopes above us. The weather, unfortunately, had no dampening effect on people's tempers. Everyone was increasingly edgy, and for obvious reason. There was still no word of Roger Wakefield. Brianna was still silent about the cause of their argument. In fact, she almost never referred to Roger any more. She had made her decision. There was nothing to do but to wait and let Roger make his, if he hadn't already. Still, I could see fear warring with anger when she left her face unguarded, and doubt hung over everyone like the clouds over the mountains. Where was he? And what would happen when, or if, he finally appeared? I took some respite from the prevailing mood of edginess by taking stock of the pantry. Winter was nearly here, the foraging was over, the garden harvested, the preserving done. The pantry shelves bulged with sacks of nuts, heaps of squash, rows of potatoes, jars of dried tomatoes, peaches and apricots, bowls of dried mushrooms, wheels of cheese, and baskets of apples. Braids of onions and garlic and strings of dried fish hung from the ceiling. Bags of flour and beans, barrels of salt beef and salt fish, and stone jars of sauerkraut stood on the floor. I counted over my hoard like a squirrel reckoning nuts, and felt soothed by our abundance. No matter what else happened, we would neither starve nor go hungry. Emerging from the pantry with a wedge of cheese in one hand and a bowl of dry beans in the other, I heard a tap on the door. Before I could call out, it opened, and Ian's head poked in, cautiously surveying the room.
"Brianna's no here?" he asked.
As she clearly wasn't, he didn't wait for an answer, but stepped in, trying to smooth back his hair.
"Have you a bit of looking-glass, auntie?" he asked. "And maybe a comb?"
"Yes, of course," I said. I set down the food, got my small mirror and the tortoiseshell comb from the drawer of the sideboy, and handed them to him, peering upward at his gangling form. His face seemed abnormally shiny, his lean cheeks blotched with red, as though he had not only shaved but had scrubbed the skin to the point of rawness. His hair, normally a thick, stubborn sheaf of soft brown, was now slicked straight back on the sides of his head with some kind of grease. Liberally pomaded with the same substance, it erupted in an untidy quiff over his forehead, making him look like a deranged porcupine. "What have you got on your hair, Ian?" I asked. I sniffed at him and recoiled slightly at the result.
"Bare fat," he said, "but it stank a bit, so I mixed in a wee scoop of incense soap to make it smell better."
He peered critically at himself in the mirror and made small jabs at his coiffure with the comb, which seemed pitifully inadequate to the task. He was wearing his good coat, with a clean shirt and, unheard of touch for a workday, a clean starched stock wrapped about his throat, looking tight enough to strangle him. "You look very nice, Ian," I said, biting the inside of my cheek. "Are you going somewhere special?"
Well, he said awkwardly. "It's just if I'm meant to be courting, like, I thought I must try to look decent."
"Courting?" I wondered at his haste. While he was certainly interested in girls, and there were a few girls in the district who made no secret of returning his interest. He was barely 17. Men did marry that young, of course, and Ian had both his own land and a share in the whisky-making. But I hadn't thought his affection so strongly engaged yet.
"I see," I said. "Is the young lady anyone I know?"
He rubbed at his jaw, raising a red flush along the bone.
"Aye, well, it's Brianna."
He wouldn't meet my eyes, but the flush rose slowly over his face.
"What?" I said incredulously.
I set down the slice of bread I was holding and stared at him.
"Did you say Brianna?"
His eyes were fixed on the floor, but his jaw was set stubbornly.
"Brianna," he repeated. "I've come to make her a proposal of marriage."
"Ian, you can't possibly mean that."
"I do," he said,
sticking out his long, square chin in a determined manner.
He glanced toward the window and shuffled his feet. "Will she... is she coming in soon, do you think?"
The sharp scent of nervous perspiration reached me, mingled with soap and bear fat, and I saw that his hands were clenched in fists, tight enough to make the knobby knuckles stand out white against his tan skin.
"Ian,"
I said, torn between exasperation and tenderness,
"are you doing this because of Brianna's baby?"
The whites of his eyes flashed as he glanced at me, startled. He nodded, shifting his shoulders uncomfortably inside the stiff coat.
"Aye, of course,"
he said, as though surprised that I should ask. "Then you're not in love with her?" I knew the answer quite well, but thought we had better have it all out.
"Well, no,"
he said, the painful blush renewing itself.
"But I'm no promise to anyone else," he hastened to add. "So that's all right."
"It's not all right," I said firmly. "Ian, that's a very, very kind notion of yours, but..."
"Oh, it's not mine," he interrupted, looking surprised. "Uncle Jimmy thought of it."
"He what?"
A loud, incredulous voice spoke behind me, and I whirled to find Brianna standing in the doorway, staring at Ian. She advanced slowly into the room, hands fisted at her sides. Just as slowly, Ian retreated, fetching up with a bump against the table.
"Cousin," he said,
with a bob of his head that dislodged a spike of greased hair. He brushed at it, but it stuck out, hanging disreputably over one eye.
I...
He saw the look on Brianna's face and promptly shut his eyes.
"I have come to express my desire to ask for your hand in the blessed sacrament of matrimony," he said in one breath.
He took in another with an audible gasp.
"I... shut up!"
Ian, his mouth open to continue, immediately shut it. He opened one eye in a cautious slit, like one viewing a bomb momentarily expected to go off. Bree glared from Ian to me. Even in the dim room I could see the tight look of her mouth and the crimson rising in her cheeks. The tip of her nose was red, whether from the nippy air outside or from annoyance I couldn't tell.
"Did you know about this?" she demanded of me.
"Of course not," I said.
"For heaven's sake, Bree!"
Before I could finish, she had whirled on her heel and run out of the door. I could see the quick flash of her rusty skirts as she hurried up the slope leading to the stable. I pulled off my apron and flung it hastily over the chair. "I'd better go after her."
"I'll go too,"
Ian offered, and I didn't stop him. Reinforcements might be needed.
"What do you think she'll do?"
he asked, panting in my wake as I hastened up the steep slope.
"God knows," I said, "but I'm afraid we're going to find out."
I was entirely too familiar with the look of a Fraser roused to fury. Neither Bree nor Jamie lost their temper easily, but when they did, they lost it thoroughly.
"I'm glad she didn't strike me," Ian said thankfully. "I thought for a moment she was going to."
He pulled even with me, his long legs outstripping mine, hurrying though I was. I could hear uplifted voices from the open half-door of the stable.
"Why on earth would you put poor little Ian up to such a thing?"
Brianna was saying, her voice high with indignation.
"I've never heard of such a high-handed, arrogant—"
"Poor little Ian," Ian said, vastly affronted. "What does she—"
"Oh,
High-handed, am I?
Jamie's voice interrupted. He sounded both impatient and irritable, though not yet angry. Perhaps I was in time to avert full-scale hostilities. I peeked through the stable door to see them face to face glaring at each other over a large pile of half-dried manure.
"And what better choice could I make? Will you tell me that?"
he demanded.
"Let me tell you, lassie, I thought of every bachelor in 50 miles before I settled on Ian. I wouldna have you wed to a cruel man or a drunkard, nor yet a poor man, nor one old enough to be your grandsire either."
He shoved a hand through his hair, sure sign of mental agitation, but made a masterful effort to calm himself. He lowered his voice a bit, trying to be conciliatory.
"Why, I even put aside Thomas MacDonald. For a while he's a fine stretch of land and a good temper, and he's an age for you. He's a pity we fell head for by, and I thought you wouldn't care to stand up side by side with him before a priest."
"Believe me, Brianna, I've done my best to see you well wed."
Bree wasn't having any. Her own hair had come loose during her dash up the hill, and was floating round her face like the flames of a vengeful archangel. "And what makes you think I want to be married to anybody at all?" His mouth dropped open.
"Want?" he said incredulously. "And what has want to do with it?"
"Everything." She stamped her foot.
"Now, there you're wrong, lassie,"
he advised her, turning to pick up his fork. He eyed her stomach with a nod.
"You've a bairn coming, who needs a name. Your time to be choosy is long since past, aye?"
He dug his fork into the pile of manure and heaved the load into the waiting barrow, then dug again with a smooth economy of motion born of years of labour.
"Now, Ian's a sweet-tempered lad and a hard worker," he said, eyes on his task. "He's got his own land. He'll have mine, too, in time, and that will..."
"I'm not going to marry anybody." Brianna drew herself up to her full height, fists balled at her sides, and spoke in a voice loud enough to disturb the bats in the corners of the ceiling. One small dark form detached itself from the shadows and flittered out into the gathering dusk, ignored by the combatants underneath.
"Well, then, make your own choice," Jamie said shortly, "and I wish you well of it."
"You are not listening," Brianna said, grinding each word between her teeth. "I've made my choice. I said I won't marry anyone." She punctuated this with another stamp of her foot. Jamie thrust the fork into the pile with a thump. He straightened up and eyed Brianna, rubbing his fist across his jaw.
"Aye, well, I seem to recall hearing a very similar opinion expressed by your mother the night before our wedding. I haven't asked her lately does she regret being forced to wed me or not, but I flatter myself she's maybe not been miserable altogether. Perhaps you should go and have a word with her."
"It's not the same thing at all," Brianna snapped.
"No, it's not,"
Jamie agreed, keeping a firm grip on his temper. The sun was low behind the hills, flooding the stable with a golden light in which the creeping tide of red in his skin was nonetheless quite visible. Still, he was making every attempt to be reasonable.
"Your mother wed me to save her life and mine. It was a brave thing she did, and generous, too. I'll grant it's no a matter of life or death. But have you no idea what it is to live branded as a wanton, or as a fatherless bastard, come to that?"
Seeing her expression falter slightly at this, he pressed his advantage, stretching out a hand to her and speaking kindly.
"Come, lassie, can you not bring yourself to do it for the bairn's sake?"
Her face tightened again, and she stepped back.
"No,"
she said, sounding strangled.
"No, I can't."
He dropped his hand. I could see them both, despite the fading light, and saw the danger signs all too clearly in the narrowing of his eyes and the set of his shoulders squared for battle.
"Is that how Frank Randall raised you, lass, to have no regard for what's right or wrong?"
Brianna was trembling all over, like a horse that's run too far.
"My father always did what was right for me,
and he would never have tried to pull something like this, she said. Never. He cared about me.
At this, Jamie finally lost his temper, which went off with a bang.
And I don't, he said. I'm not trying my best to do what's right for you, in spite of your being...
Jamie. I turned toward him, saw his eyes gone black with anger, and turned toward her. Bree, I know he didn't... You have to understand.
You self-righteous, insensitive bastard!
Bastard? You call me a bastard, and your belly's swelling like a pumpkin with a child that you mean to doom to finger-pointing and calumny for all its days, and
anyone points a finger at my child and I'll break it off and stuff it down their throat.
You senseless wee bism. Have you no the faintest notion of how things are? You'll be a scandal and a hissing. Folk will call you whore to your face.
Let them try it.
Oh, let them try it. And you mean me to stand by and listen, I suppose?
It's not your job to defend me.
He was so furious that his face went white as fresh bleached muslin.
Not my job to defend you. For Christ's sake, woman, who else is meant to do it?
Ian tugged gently on my arm, drawing me back.
You've only the twa choices now, auntie, he murmured in my ear. Douse them both with a pan of cold water. Oh, come away with me and leave them to it.
I've seen Uncle Jamie and my mam go at it before.
Believe me, you dinna want to step between two freezers wi' the dander up. My da said he's tried once or twice and got the scars to prove it.
I took a final glance at the situation and gave up. He was right. They were nose to nose, red hair bristling and eyes slitted like a couple of bobcats circling, spitting and snarling. I could have set the hay on fire, and neither one would have spared an instant's notice. It seemed remarkably quiet and peaceful outside. A whippoorwill sang in the aspen grove, and the wind was in the east, carrying the faint sounds of the waterfall to us. By the time we reached the dooryard, we couldn't hear the shouting any more.
"Dinna be worried, auntie,"
Ian said comfortingly.
"They'll get hungry sooner or later."
In the event, it was unnecessary to starve them out. Jamie stamped down the hill a few minutes later, and without a word fetched his horse down from the paddock, bridled him, mounted, and rode bareback at a gallop down the track toward Fergus's cabin. As I watched his departing form, Brianna stalked out of the stable, puffing like a steam engine, and made for the house.
"What does Nian na Galach mean?" she demanded, seeing me at the door.
"I don't know," I said.
I did, but thought it much more prudent not to say.
"I'm sure he didn't mean it," I added.
"Whatever it means."
"Ha!" she said, and with an angry snort stomped into the house, reappearing moments later with the egg basket over her arm. Without a word, she disappeared into the bushes, making a rustling noise like a hurricane. I took several deep breaths and went in to start supper, cursing Roger Wakefield. Physical exertion seemed to have dissipated at least some of the negative energy in the household. Brianna spent an hour in the bushes and returned with 16 eggs and a calmer face. There were leaves and stickers in her hair, and from the look of her shoes she'd been kicking trees. I didn't know what Jamie had been doing, but he returned at supper time, sweaty and wind-blown, but outwardly calm. They pointedly ignored each other, a reasonably difficult feat for two large persons confined in a 20-foot square log cabin. I glanced at Ian, who rolled his eyes skyward, and came to help carry the big serving bowl to the table. Conversation over supper was limited to requests to pass the salt, and afterward Brianna cleared the dishes, then went to sit at the spinning wheel, working the foot treadle with unnecessary emphasis. Jamie gave her back a glare, then jerked his head at me and went out. He was waiting on the path to the privy when I followed him a moment later.
"What am I to do?" he demanded without preamble.
"Apologize," I said.
"Apologize?"
His hair seemed to be standing on end, though it was likely only the effects of the wind.
"But I haven't done anything wrong."
"Well, what difference does that make?"
I said, exasperated.
You asked me what you should do, and I told you.
He exhaled strongly through his nose, hesitated a moment, then turned and stalked back into the house, shoulders set for martyrdom or battle.
I apologize, he said,
looming up in front of her. Surprised, she nearly dropped the yarn, but caught it adeptly.
Oh,
she said, and flushed. She took her foot off the treadle, and the great wheel creaked and slowed.
I was wrong,
he said, with a quick look at me. I nodded encouragingly, and he cleared his throat.
I shouldn't have...
It's all right.
She spoke quickly, eager to meet him. You didn't...
I mean, you were only trying to help.
She looked down at the thread, slowing as it ran through her fingers.
I'm sorry, too. I shouldn't have been mad at you.
He closed his eyes briefly and sighed, then opened them and lifted one eyebrow at me. I smiled faintly and turned back to my work, pounding fennel seeds in the mortar. He pulled up a stool and sat down beside her, and she turned toward him, putting one hand on the wheel to stop it.
I know you meant well, she said, you and Ian both. But don't you see, Dar, I have to wait for Roger.
But if something has happened to the man, if he's met with an accident of some kind...
He isn't dead. I know he isn't.
She spoke with the fervency of someone who means to bend reality to her will.
He'll come back. And how would it be if he did, and found me married to Ian?
Ian looked up, hearing his name. He sat on the floor by the fire, Rollo's great head resting on his knee, his yellow wolf eyes mere slits of pleasure, as Ian methodically combed through the thick pelt, pulling out ticks and burrs as he found them. Jamie ran his fingers through his hair in a gesture of frustration.
I've had word out since you told me of him, Ian. I sent Ian to Cross Creek to leave word at River Run, and with Captain Freeman to pass to the other rivermen. I've sent Duncan, we word, all through the Cape Fear Valley, and as far north as Edenton and New Bern, and with the packet boats that run from Virginia to Charleston.
He looked at me, pleading for understanding.
What more can I do? The man is nowhere to be found. If I thought there were the slightest chance...
He stopped, teeth set in his lip. Brianna dropped her gaze to the yarn in her hand, and with a quick, sharp gesture, snapped it. Leaving the loose end to flap from the spindle, she got up and crossed the room, sitting down at the table with her back to us.
I'm sorry, lass, Jamie said more quietly.
He reached out and laid a hand on her shoulder, gingerly, as though she might bite him. She stiffened slightly, but didn't pull away. After a moment, she reached up and took his hand, squeezing it lightly, then putting it aside.
I see, she said. Thank you, Da.
She sat, eyes fixed on the flames, her face and figure utterly still, but managing to radiate complete desolation. I put my hands on her shoulders, rubbing gently, but she felt like a wax mannequin under my fingers, not resisting, but not acknowledging the touch. Jamie studied her for a moment, frowning, and glanced at me. Then, with an air of decision, he got up and reached to the shelf, brought down his inkhorn and quill jar, and set them on the table with a clank.
"Here's a thought," he said firmly. "Let us draw up a broadsheet here, and I will take it to Gillette in Wilmington. He can print it up, and Ian and the Lindsay lads will take the copies up and down the coast from Charleston to Jamestown. It may be that someone's not Kent Wakefield, not hearing his name, but they'll maybe know him by his looks."
He shook ink powder, made of iron and oak gall, into the stained half-gourd he used as a well, and poured a little water from the pitcher, using the shaft of a quill to stir the ink. He smiled at Brianna, and took a sheet of paper from the drawer.
"Now then, lass, how is this man of yours to look at?"
The suggestion of action had brought a spark of life back into Brianna's face. She sat up straighter, and a current of energy flowed up her spine into my fingers.
"Tall," she said. nearly as tall as you, dear. People would notice. They always look at you. He has black hair and green eyes. Bright green. It's one of the first things you notice about him, isn't it, Mama?
Ian gave a small start and looked up from his grooming.
Yes, I said, sitting down on the bench next to Brianna. But you can maybe do better than just the written description.
Bree's a good hand with a likeness, I explained to Jamie.
Can you draw Roger from memory, do you think, Bree?
Yes.
She reached for the quill, eager to try. Yes, I'm sure I can. I've drawn him before.
Jamie surrendered the quill and paper, the vertical lines between his brows showing in a slight frown.
Can the printer work from an ink sketch? I asked, seeing it.
Oh, I expect so. It's no great matter to make a woodblock if the lines are clear.
He spoke abstractedly, eyes fixed on the paper in front of Brianna. Ian pushed Rollo's head off his knee and came to stand by the table, looking over Bree's shoulder in what seemed a rather exaggerated curiosity. Lower lip fixed between her teeth, she drew clean and swiftly. High forehead, with a thick lock of black hair that rose from an invisible cowlick, then dipped almost to the strongly marked black brows. She drew him in profile, a bold nose, not quite beaky, a clean-lined, sensitive mouth, and a wide, slanted jaw. Thick-lashed eyes, deep-set, with lines of good humour marking a strong, appealing face. She added a neat, flat ear, then turned her attention to the elegant curve of the skull, drawing thick, wavy, dark hair pulled back in a short tail. Ian made a small, strangled noise in his throat.
"Are you all right, Ian?"
I looked up at him, but he wasn't looking at the drawing. He was looking across the table at Jamie. He was wearing a glazed sort of expression, like a pig on a spit. I turned to find precisely the same expression on Jamie's face.
"What on earth is the matter?" I asked.
"Oh, nothing."
The muscles of his throat moved in a convulsive swallow. The corner of his mouth twitched, and twitched again as though he couldn't control it.
"Like hell it is!"
Alarmed, I leaned across the table, seizing his wrist and groping for his pulse.
"Jamie, what is it? Are you having chest pains? Do you feel ill?"
"I do."
Ian was leaning over the table, looking as though he might be going to throw up any minute.
"'Cuz, do you mean honestly to tell me that this..."
He gestured feebly at the sketch.
"Is Roger Wakefield?"
"Yes," she said, looking up at him in puzzlement. "Ian, are you all right? Did you eat something funny?"
He didn't answer, but dropped heavily onto the bench beside her, put his head in his hands, and groaned. Jamie gently detached his hand from my grip. Even in the red of the firelight, I could see that he was white and strained. The hand on the table curled around the quill jar as though seeking support.
"Mr. Wakefield," he said carefully to Brianna, "has he by any chance another name?"
"Yes," Brianna and I said in unison.
I stopped and let her explain as I rose and went hurriedly to fetch a bottle of brandy from the pantry. I didn't know what was going on, but had the horrible feeling that it was about to be called for.
"Adopted. Mackenzie was his own family name," she was saying as I emerged with the bottle in hand. She glanced from father to cousin, frowning. "Why? You haven't heard of a Roger Mackenzie, have you?"
Jamie and Ian exchanged an appalled glance. Ian cleared his throat. So did Jamie.
"What?"
Brianna demanded, leaning forward, glancing anxiously from one to the other.
"What is it? Have you seen him? Where?"
I saw Jamie's jaw tighten as he summoned up words.
"Aye,"
he said carefully.
"We have. On the mountain."
"What? Here? On this mountain?"
She stood up, pushing back the bench. Alarm and excitement played over her face like flames.
"Where is he? What happened?"
"Well," Ian said defensively, "he did see as he'd taken your maidenhead after all."
"He what?"
Brianna's eyes sprang open so far that a rim of white showed all around the iris.
Well, your da asked him, just to be sure, and he admitted that he'd...
You what?
Brianna rounded on Jamie, clenched fists on the table.
Aye, well, it was a mistake, Jamie said.
He looked utterly wretched.
You bet it was. What in the name of...
What have you done?
Her own cheeks had blanched, and blue sparks glinted in her eyes, hot as the heart of a flame.
Jamie took a deep breath. He looked up, straight into her face, and set his jaw.
"The wee lassie," he said, "Lizzie. She told me that you were with child, and that the man who'd got it on you was a wicked brute called Mackenzie."
Brianna's mouth opened and shut, but no words came out. Jamie looked at her steadily.
"You did say to me that you'd been violated, did you know?"
She nodded, jerky as a badly sprung puppet.
"So then, Ian and the lassie were at the mill when Mackenzie came asking for you. They rode to fetch me, and Ian and I met him in the clearing just above the green spring."
Brianna had got her voice working, though only barely.
"What did you do to him?" she asked hoarsely.
"What?" "It was a fair fight," Ian said, still defensive. "I wanted to shoot him on sight, but Uncle Jamie said no. He meant to have his hands on the man."
"You hit him?"
"Aye, I did," Jamie said, stung at last. "For God's sake, woman, what would you have me do to the man who'd used you that way? It was you wanting to do murder, aye?" "Besides, he hit Uncle Jamie too," Ian put in helpfully. "It was a fair fight," I said.
"Be quiet, Ian. There's a good lad," I said.
I poured two fingers neat and pushed the cup in front of Jamie.
"But it was... he wasn't..."
Brianna was sputtering like a firecracker with a short fuse lit. Then she caught fire and slammed one fist on the table, going off like a rocket.
"What have you done with him?" she screamed.
Jamie blinked and Ian flinched. They exchanged haunted glances. I put a hand on Jamie's arm, squeezing tight. I couldn't keep the quaver out of my own voice as I asked the necessary question. "Jamie, did you kill him?" He glanced at me, and the tension in his face relaxed, if only marginally.
No, he said. "I gave him to the Iroquois." "Och, now, cuz, it could have been worse."
Ian patted Brianna tentatively on the back.
"We didn't kill him, after all."
Brianna made a small choking sound and pulled her head up off her knees. Her face was white and damp as the inside of an oyster shell, her hair in a tangle round it. She hadn't vomited or fainted, but looked as though she still might do either.
"We did mean to,"
Ian went on, looking at her a little nervously.
"I'd my pistol pressed behind his ear. But then I thought it was really Uncle Jamie's right to blow his brains out, but then he..."
Brianna choked again, and I hastily placed an ashet on the table in front of her, just in case.
"Ian, I really think she doesn't need to hear this just now," I said, narrowing my eyes at him.
"Yes, I do."
Brianna pushed herself upright, hands gripping the edge of the table.
"I have to hear it all. I have to."
She turned her head slowly, as though her neck was stiff, toward Jamie.
"Why?" she said. "Why?"
He was as white and ill-looking as she was. He had pushed away from the table and gone to the chimney corner as though trying to get as far away as possible from the drawing with its damning likeness of Roger Mackenzie Wakefield. He looked as though he would have done anything rather than answer, but answer he did, his eyes steady on hers.
"I meant to kill him. I stopped Ian because shooting the prick seemed too easy a death, too quick for what he'd done."
He took a deep breath, and I could see that the hand gripping his writing shelf was clenched so tight that the knuckles stood out white against his skin.
"I stopped to think how it should be, what I must do. I left Ian with him, and I walked away."
He swallowed. I could see the muscles move in his throat, but he didn't look away.
"I walked into the forest a wee way and leaned my back against a tree to let my heart slow. It seemed best he should be awake to know, but I didna think I could bear to hear him speak again. He'd said too much already. But then I began to hear it over again, what he'd said.
What? What did he say?
Even her lips were white.
So were Jamie's.
He said that you'd asked him to your bed, that you...
He stopped and bit his lip savagely.
He said you wanted him, that you'd asked him to take your maidenhead, Ian said.
He spoke coolly, his eyes on Brianna. She drew in breath with a ragged sound like paper being torn.
I did.
I glanced involuntarily at Jamie. His eyes were closed, his teeth fixed in his lip. Ian made a shocked sound, and Brianna drew back a hand like lightning and slapped him across the face. He jerked back, lost his balance, and half fell off the bench. He grabbed the edge of the table and staggered to his feet.
How? He shouted, his face contorted in sudden anger. How could you do such a thing? I told Uncle Jamie that you'd never play the whore, never. But it's true, isn't it?
She was on her feet like a leopard, her cheeks gone from white to blazing fury in a second.
Well, damn you for a self-righteous prig, Ian. Who gave you the right to call me a whore?
Right?
He sputtered for a moment, at a loss for words.
He?
Before I could intervene, she drew back a fist and punched him hard in the pit of the stomach. With a look of intense surprise, he sat down hard on the floor, mouth open like a suckling pig. I moved, but Jamie was faster. In less than a second, he was beside her, gripping her arm. She whirled, meaning to hit him too, I think, but then froze. Her mouth was working soundlessly, tears of shock and fury running down her cheeks.
"Be still," he said,
and his voice was very cold. I saw his fingers dig into her flesh, and I made a small sound of protest. He paid no attention, too intent on Brianna.
"I did not want to believe it," he said,
in a voice like ice.
"I told myself he was only saying so to save himself. It wasn't a true. But if it was..."
He seemed to become aware at last that he was hurting her. He let go of her arm.
"I couldn't take the man's life without being sure," he said,
and paused, his eyes searching her face.
"For regret," I wondered, "or remorse?"
Whatever he might be looking for, all he found was a smouldering rage. Her face was the echo of his own, her blue eyes hot as his. His own face changed, and he looked away.
"I did regret it," he said very quietly, "when I came that night and saw you. I was sorry then that I hadna killed him. I held you in my arms, and I felt my heart go small with shame that I should doubt my daughter's virtue."
He looked down, and I could see the mark where he had bitten his lip.
"Now my heart has shrunk altogether. Not only that you should be impure, but that you should lie to me."
"Lie to you?"
Her voice was no more than a whisper.
"Lie to you?"
"Aye, lie to me."
With sudden violence, he turned back to her.
"That you should bed a man from lust and cry rape when you find you're with child. Do you not realise that it's only chance I have not the sin of murder on my soul, and you the cause of it?"
She was too furious to speak. I saw her throat swell with words, and knew I had to do something at once, before either of them had the opportunity to say more. I couldn't speak either. Blindly, I fumbled in the pocket of my gown, feeling for the ring. I found it, pulled it out, and dropped it on the table. It chimed against the wood, spun, and rattled to a stop, the gold of the tiny circlet gleaming red in the firelight. From F to C with love, always. Jamie looked at it, his face gone completely blank. Brianna drew in her breath with a sob.
"That's your ring, auntie," Ian said.
He sounded dazed and bent close to look, as though he couldn't believe his eyes.
"Your gold ring? The one that Bonnet took from you on the river?"
"Yes," I said. My knees felt weak. I sat down at the table and laid my hand over the telltale ring, as though to take it back, deny its presence.
Jamie took my wrist and lifted it. Like a man handling a dangerous insect, he picked the ring up gingerly between thumb and forefinger.
"Where did you get this?" he asked,
his voice almost casual. He looked at me, and a bolt of terror shot through me at the look in his eyes.
"I brought it to her."
Brianna's tears had dried, evaporated by the heat of her fury. She stood behind me and gripped me by the shoulders.
"Don't you look at her that way! Don't you dare!"
He shifted the look to her, but she didn't flinch, only held on to me harder, her fingers digging into my shoulders.
"Where did you get it?"
he asked again, his voice no more than a whisper.
"Where?"
"From him. From Stephen Bonnet." Her voice was shaky, but from rage, not fear.
"When he raped me."
Jamie's face cracked suddenly as though some explosion had burst him from within. I made an incoherent sound of distress and reached out for him, but he whirled away and stood rigid, back turned to us in the middle of the room. I felt Brianna draw herself upright, heard Ian say rather stupidly,
"Bonnet."
I heard the ticking of the clock on the sideboard, felt the draught from the door. I was dimly aware of all these things, but had no eyes for anything but Jamie. I pushed back the bench and stumbled to my feet. He stood as though rooted into the floor, fists clenched into his belly like a man gut-shot, trying to hold back the inevitable fatal spill of his insides. I should be able to do something, to say something. I should be able to help them, to take care of them. But I could do nothing. I couldn't help one without betraying the other. Had already betrayed them both. I had sold Jamie's honour to keep him safe, and the doing of it had taken Roger and destroyed Bree's happiness. I could go to neither of them now. All I could do was stand there, feeling my heart crumble into small, jagged chunks. Bree left me and walked quietly around the table, across the room, around Jamie. She stood in front of him, looking up into his face, her own set like marble, cold as a saint's.
"Damn you," she said, scarcely audible.
"Damn you very much, you bastard. I'm sorry I ever saw you." Part 11. Budget 2. Chapter 51. Betrayal. October 1769. Roger opened his eyes and threw up, or rather, down. It didn't matter. The burning rush of bile through his nose and the trickle of vomitus that ran into his hair were unimportant by comparison with the agony in head and groin. A thumping swerve of movement jarred him, shooting kaleidoscopic colours from crotch to brain. A damp smell of canvas filled his nose. Then a voice spoke somewhere near, and formless panic took sudden jagged shape among the colours.
"Gloriana. They got him."
He lurched in reflex, brought up short by a searing jolt through his temples, but brought up a split second earlier by something round his wrists. Tied. He was tied up in the hold. The shape of panic blew up bald and black against his mind. Bonnet. They'd caught him, taken back the stones, and now they'd kill him. He jerked convulsively, yanking at his wrists, teeth clenched against the pain. The deck dropped beneath him with a startled snort, and he slammed down hard. He vomited again, but his stomach was empty. He retched, ribs grating with each spasm against the canvas-wrapped bundles he lay across. Not sails. Not a hold. Not the Gloriana. Not a ship at all. A horse. He was tied hand and foot, belly down across a fucking horse. The horse jolted on a few more steps, then stopped. Voices muttered, hands fumbled at him. Then he was pulled off roughly and dropped on his feet. He fell down at once, unable either to stand or to break his fall. He lay half-doubled on the ground, concentrating on breathing. Without the jouncing, it was easier. Nobody troubled him,
and gradually he began to be aware of his surroundings.
Awareness didn't help much. There were damp leaves under his cheek, cool and smelling of sweet rot. He cracked a cautious eye. Sky above, an impossible deep colour between blue and purple. The sound of trees, the rush of nearby water. Everything seemed to be revolving slowly around him, painfully vivid. He closed his eyes and pressed his hands flat against the ground.
Jesus, where am I?
The voices were talking casually, words half lost in the stamping and whickering of nearby horses. He listened intently, but couldn't make out the words. He felt a moment's panic at the inability. He couldn't even put a name to the language. There was a large, tender lump behind one ear, another on the back of his head, and a pain that made his temples throb. He'd been hit hard. But when? Had the blows ruptured vessels in his brain, deprived him of language? He opened his eyes all the way, and, with infinite caution, rolled onto his back. A square brown face glanced down at him with no particular expression of interest, then looked back to the horse the man was tending. Indians! The shock was so great that he forgot momentarily about his pain and sat up abruptly. He gasped and put his face on his knees, eyes closed as he fought to keep from passing out again, blood pounding through a splitting head. Where was he? He bit his knee, grinding the cloth savagely between his teeth, fighting for memory. Fragments of images came back to him, in mocking bits that stubbornly refused to fit together into sense. The creak of boards and the smell of bilges, blinding sun through panes of glass, Bonnet's face, and the breathing of whales in the mist, and a little boy named... Hands clasped in dark and the tang of hops. I thee wed, with my body I thee worship. Bree, Brianna. Cold sweat rolled down his cheek and his jaw muscles ached with clenching. The images hopped around in his mind like fleas. Her face, he mustn't let it go. Not gentle, not a gentle face. A nose dead straight and cold blue eyes. No, not cold. A hand on his shoulder yanked him from the tortured pursuit of memory into the all-too-immediate present. It was an Indian, knife in hand. Numb with confusion, Roger simply looked at the man. The Indian, a middle-aged man with a bone in his roached hair and an air of no nonsense about him, took Roger by his own hair and tilted his head back and forth with a critical air. Confusion evaporated as it occurred to Roger that he was about to be scalped as he sat there. He flung himself backward and lashed out with his feet, catching the Indian in the knees. The man went down with a cry of surprise, and Roger rolled, lurching and stumbling to his feet, running for his life. He ran like a drunken spider, spraddle-legged, staggering toward the trees, shadows, refuge. There were shouts behind him and the sound of quick feet scattering leaves. Then something jerked his feet from under him, and he fell headlong with a bone-shaking thud. They had him on his feet before he had his breath back. No good to struggle. There were four of them, including the one Roger had knocked down. That one came toward them, limping, still holding the knife. "Not hurt you," he said crossly. He slapped Roger briskly across the face, then leaned over and sawed through the leather thong that bound Roger's wrists. With a loud snort, he turned on his heel and then went back to the horses. The two men holding Roger promptly let go of him and walked off, too, leaving him swaying like a sapling in a high wind. Great, he thought blankly. I'm not dead. What the bloody hell? No answer to this presenting itself, he rubbed a hand gingerly over his face, discovering several bruises he'd missed earlier, and looked around. He stood in a small clearing, surrounded by huge oaks and half-shed hickory trees. The ground was thick with brown and yellow leaves, and the squirrels had left heaps of acorn caps and nut hulls scattered over the ground. He stood on a mountain. The slope of the ground told him that.
as the chill air and dual deep sky told him the time was near sunset. The Indians, there were four, all men, ignored him completely, going about the business of camp building without a glance in Roger's direction. He licked dry lips and took a cautious step toward the small stream that burbled over algae-furred rocks a few yards away. He drank his fill, though the cold water made his teeth ache. Nearly all the teeth were loose on one side of his mouth, and the lining of his cheek was badly cut. He rinsed his face gingerly with a feeling of déjà vu. Sometime earlier he had washed and drunk like this, cold water running over emerald rocks. Fraser's Ridge. He sat back on his heels, memory dropping back in place in large, ugly chunks. Brianna and Claire and Jamie Fraser. Suddenly the confusing image he had sought so desperately came back unbidden. Brianna's face, with its broad, clean bones, blue eyes set slantwise above a long, straight nose. But Brianna's face grown older, weathered to bronze, rough cut and toughened by masculinity and experience. Blue eyes gone black with a murderous rage. Jamie Fraser.
"You bloody sod," Roger said softly. "You bloody fucking sod. You tried to kill me."
His initial feeling was one of astonishment, but anger wasn't far behind. He remembered everything now, the meeting in the clearing, the autumn leaves like fire and honey, and the blazing man among them, the brown-haired youth. And who the hell was he? The fight. He touched a sore spot under his ribs with a grimace. And the end of it, lying flat in the leaves, sure that he was about to be killed. Well, he hadn't been. He had a dim memory of hearing the man and the boy arguing somewhere over him. One of them had been for killing him on the spot. The other said no, but damned if he knew which one. Then one of them had hit him again, and he remembered nothing more until now. And now? He glanced around. The Indians had a fire going and a clay pot sitting by it. None of them paid him the least attention, though he was sure they were all aware of him. Perhaps they'd taken him from Fraser and the boy. Why, though? More likely, Fraser had given him to the Indians. The man with the knife had said they didn't mean to hurt him. What did they mean to do with him? He looked around. It would be night soon. Already the distant shadows under the oaks had thickened. So what, sport? If you slope up after dark, where are you going to go? The only direction you know is down. The Indians were apparently ignoring him because they were confident that he wasn't going anywhere. Dismissing the uncomfortable truth of this observation, he stood up. First things first. It was the last thing he wanted to do at the moment, but his bladder was bursting. His fingers were slow and clumsy, congested with blood, but he managed to fumble loose the lacing of his breeches. His first feeling was one of relief. It wasn't as bad as it felt. Very sore, but ginger prodding seemed to indicate that he was basically intact and unruptured. It was only as he turned back toward the fire that simple relief was succeeded by a burst of rage so pure and blinding as to burn away both pain and fear. On his right wrist was a smudged black oval, a thumbprint, clear and mocking as a signature. "Christ," he said, very softly. Fury burned hot and thick in the pit of his belly. He could taste it, sour in his mouth. He looked down the mountainside behind him, not knowing whether he faced Fraser's Ridge or not. "Wait for me, bugger," he said under his breath. "Both of you. Wait for me. I'm coming back." Not right away, though. The Indians allowed him to share the food, a sort of stew which they scooped up with their hands in spite of its near-boiling temperature, but were otherwise indifferent to him. He tried them in English, French, even the small bits of German that he knew, but got no response. They did tie him when they lay down to sleep. His ankles were bound and a noose put round his neck, tied to the wrist of one of his captors. Whether from indifference, or because there wasn't one, They didn't give him a blanket, and he spent the night shivering, huddled as close to the dwindling fire as he could get without choking himself.